Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It was just the most massive thing I've ever seen. To tell you the honest truth, I thought, well, we're the only ones left on this planet. Something's happened. We've missed something here.
The fear that went in me when I seen it was just the feeling. I'd say it was fear, but I've never felt that feeling before in my entire life.
It's a weird feeling, like you can't explain it when you don't know. You feel like you're being followed, but you don't know what it is.
We had two to our right, another one in front of us, another one to the left, and another one just across the road, shaking the daylight out of the tree. All we get is a big red eye.
I remember waking up and looking at the end of the bed, and there was a figure there, almost insect-like, and then I blacked out.
Welcome to the show, everyone. My name is Cade Moyer, and you are listening to the Believe Paranormal and UFO podcast. If you have had an encounter and would like to share it, please get in touch with me. My email address is believepod@gmail.com. If you enjoy the podcast, be sure to leave us a rating or review wherever you listen and head on over to our website, believepod.com, and consider becoming a member to get bonus episodes and video content. Tonight I'm joined by Kieran, and Kieran is a bit of a war historian, and he came across a rather unique piece of World War One history and has quite a tale to tell with it. So Kieran, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Cade. It's great them being on the show.
Mate, it's fantastic to have you on. We've been talking before we hit record for about 20 minutes now, and I feel like we are the oldest of friends. Mate, you are one of the most spectacular talkers I've ever met. The way that you just kind of speak about the encounters that you've had is so incredible and so powerful, because what we're going to talk about tonight is a rather unique and interesting kind of encounter, which I always love when it comes to the show, because I always try to put unique and different stories on here, and yours is definitely one of those. But I have a feeling we're probably going to get you back on again, because you have kind of spilled the beans to me that you have a whole bunch of other things that have happened to you, essentially. But tell me, what happened here with this World War One collectible that you've got?
No worries. Well, look, I'll start right from the beginning. Because it's probably pretty important to really paint the picture of how it all fell into place. As you said, I do collect war memorabilia, and I have done since I was about 6 years old. And you know, my father gave me a little collar badge, Rising Sun, and that was the very first thing that actually belonged to his stepfather. And from there, you know, my interest grew just from a badge. And I just like collecting things, you know, and I'd go to antique shops and all this sort of stuff, and I'd just go looking for things, and I'd read books. Yeah, I still have a really big book collection, and my interest just grew and grew and grew. And look, over the years, I just really started collecting. Probably more so when I hit my teens, when I became an apprentice, and I could actually go out and start really buying things. But my interest really sort of kicked off when I started collecting sections of postcards and diaries and documents and things like this. Now, these things don't just get locked away. When I was in my teens, I would actually go to schools or give talks and that sort of stuff. And so I'd actually go and produce my collection and show school kids, like swords and the uniforms and bits and pieces, and just to give a little bit of an idea of what it was like to be a soldier during the First World War or the Second World War or so forth. This is really where my real interest really kicked off. It was probably more so in my teens when I was studying history at high school and getting a real good feel for this sort of stuff. And it was actually during one of these occasions when I was actually at a school with an exhibit and I was talking to a heap of students that my parents actually turned up just to see what was happening because I was still only a teenager at the time. And it just so happened there was another older gentleman who turned up who was actually my dad's old butcher. And now this is a funny sort of connection, but that this man actually stood back and watched what I was doing and how I was interacting with all these kids. And he just came and approached me and he said, look, I've got something that you might like. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, well, yeah. And he just vanished. No sooner did he talk to me, he just disappeared. And about 20 minutes later, he just turned up. And he said, look, I've got this. I don't really have anyone to pass it on to. I want it to be safe. I'd like you to have it. And he just handed me over this little booklet. And he just sort of stood there and he just nodded his head and he said, this belonged to my uncle. He died during the First World War. Yeah, I'm sure that you look after it. And with that, he pretty much just turned and walked away. So this was, this was a little bit of a shock at the time. Here I was only about 19 years old. And when I opened up the book, this little diary, it was actually a First World War diary, but it was a First World War battlefield diary. And it had belonged to a soldier from Victoria, a country of Victoria. He was from a place called Tallangatha. Now, Tallangatha is actually, I believe it's near Albury, but eventually a portion of Tallangatha went underwater when they brought the Snowy River scheme through. So they actually shifted the actual town centre about 6 kilometres in a different direction. So, but Tallangatha still does exist as a town, but a lot of it actually got side-shifted. So, but getting back to this diary, it belonged to a young gentleman. At the time of him writing the diary, he was only 19 years old, and his name was James Council. Now, at this point, the diary actually starts with him doing his basic training in Egypt, and he had been assigned to the 5th Australian Battalion. Now, what the diary doesn't actually tell you is he'd already enlisted in a previous battalion where he'd actually gone over to Egypt, and he was actually being prepared to go to Gallipoli. All his mates went to Gallipoli, he didn't. He actually had developed a bit of an infection whilst he was having a bit of fun in Egypt, and he was actually sent home. They put him on a ship and sent him home. But when he arrived back in Australia, the condition had actually cleared up. They reassigned him to a different battalion, which was the 5th, and off he went. He was sent back over. This time he went to his basic training in Egypt once again, and then he was shipped off to France. So 19 years old, that's quite phenomenal to think that people at that age were being sent off to war. But it does appear with the whole story that when you actually look through his service records, which I do now have, there is a piece of paper which basically says, I give my son permission to be a soldier, signed. It's almost like a signed Mr. Council or something like that. So it almost even seems, because you actually had to be 21 to enlist without your parents' permission. So I don't know how legit this permission note was that was actually written by his father. But that's neither here nor there. I can't really answer that question. But so he was actually assigned to the 5th Battalion, and he ended up in France. Now, I didn't actually know any of this at the time. Basically, the only details that I could actually find out back in the 90s was very, very, very basic details, which was the fact that he was actually killed in action, and he was killed in action on the 25th of July 1916. Now, I knew that this was actually the Battle of Pozieres, and the Battle of Pozieres was one of the most horrific battles that the Australians took part in. It's actually C.E.W. Bean, who was the main war historian for the First War. He actually describes Pozieres as there hasn't been another place in the world where there was more blood sown in the fields other than Pozieres. Yeah, we had 23,000 casualties there. In a matter of 6 weeks. It was just mind blowing. So, but this diary, it is quite fascinating, and he actually does spend these. So, like I said, he was 19 when he enlisted. He went across, and the time frame is quite incredible. But he does actually spend his 21st birthday in this little town called Albert. And Albert, now, when I mentioned that this town of Albert, that will come into the story I'm going to progress a little bit later on. but he spent his 21st birthday there, and he actually makes mention of this in his diary. And then he moves up to the front line, which was captured by, you know, the German trenches, which had been previously captured by, I believe that may have been the 2nd Battalion, but they actually moved up there into support, into the old German front line. And then the diary actually states on the 24th of July, 1916, it actually says, "We hop over tonight, God knows what the end will be." And that is the last entry. You know, that the records state that he lost his life on the 25th. So, and he turned the page over and he actually states he has like a bit of a last will, you could say, where he actually asks that if anything happens to him for the diary to be passed on to his mother. And he gives an address in Thalangala, Victoria. So, mate, just to be given this diary was mind-blowing at my age. And I almost immediately felt whenever it was Anzac Day or whenever it was any sort of like commemoration, I just felt I had to put this diary in the pocket of my heart and attend all these ceremonies. So whether it was a dawn service or a Remembrance Day service, I would always carry this diary with me. So I did carry on, you know, giving, you know, talks and doing exhibits, that sort of stuff. And then I met my future wife. Yeah, we got married, and we actually got the travel bug, and my wife actually suggested that, yeah, why don't we go over and go over to France, yeah, to the battlefields of France. And I said, that would be amazing. So we did, yeah, we saved up our hard-earned dollars, and then we planned a trip, but we actually planned our trip through France around his diary. So the places that he went to throughout his diary, we actually made a point of going to those places.
Oh, wow.
And in fact, the town of Albert, where he spent his 21st birthday, is where we actually set ourselves up. We based ourselves out of the pub in Albert, and that was our little, you know, starting point to go to all these, you know, places throughout France. And that alone was, you know, pretty amazing. Just the fact that we're over there, the fact that my lovely wife was happy to go on and walk around sandwiches with me on an overseas holiday. I think that was, you know, a lot of wives probably wouldn't do that. But,
mate, I think you've struck gold there.
Yeah. Look, I won't admit that too much, mate. She might be listening, mate. She was pretty fantastic, giving directions and that sort of stuff, because, yeah, some of those little backcountry roads in France were a little bit difficult to find, and, you know, we'll work off of what was essentially little mud mats finding our way around. So, when we got to France, so this is back in 1999, so, you know, like I said, I was given a diary about 7 years prior to this, and I had, you know, utilized it, you know, for ceremonies, giving talks and that sort of stuff. And then when I went to France, I actually took a transcript. I didn't take the diary itself. I actually took a transcript with me. And so, you know, we started off going to a few different cemeteries, going to a few museums. We were trying to work ourselves in amongst some pretty ordinary weather as well. So when it was raining, we'd go indoors, and when it was good weather, we'd go outdoors. And we had been to other cemeteries previous. But it was when I went to the Pozieres Cemetery that things, yeah, interesting things happened there. Now, the Pozieres Cemetery, unlike a lot of other cemeteries, is actually surrounded by marble walls. And, on those walls are the names of the British Fifth Army that was wiped out during the April March offensives, during 1918. So, but the interior, there's about 2,700 graves. And a good portion of those men are actually Australians, because it was actually the Australians that which launched the attacks during 1916 at Pozieres. So naturally, a lot of the graves situated inside the cemetery are Australian. Now, I knew that my soldier, James Council, didn't have a known grave. And like I said, at this stage, that was all I knew. He didn't have a known grave, which could mean that he was buried in an unmarked grave. He could be buried out in the field. His bones might have been churned up by ploughs in the fields, which is quite often what happens these days. It was all speculation. So we got to this cemetery at Pozieres, and me and my wife, we're walking around inside the cemetery, and it just felt funny. Unlike all the other cemeteries, there was just a weird feel to this place. And I started to get a little bit emotional, and I looked at my wife, and she was sort of diagonally across from where I was. And I just started walking over towards her. And I started walking up this one row, and I started to hyperventilate. Now, I'm not an asthmatic or anything like that, but I was struggling to breathe. And, mate, I broke out into goosebumps. I felt sick. But I actually collapsed. Yeah, I was dead set struggling. My wife, who, yeah, she's actually a nurse. Yeah, she saw me collapse, and she ran. Yeah, she ran from one side to the other to where I was. And here I was down on one knee. And, mate, it was the weirdest experience. But before my wife actually got to me, here I was, I'm struggling to breathe, and I felt someone put their hand on my shoulder. And, look, the only way I can really describe it now, mate, whenever I talk about this, I break out in goosebumps, and that's exactly what's happened to me now. I'm feeling sick. that's bizarre. I knew this was going to happen. This always happens whenever I tell the story. So, yeah, if I sound a bit jittery while I'm talking, that this is just what happens. So I, here I am. I'm on my knee. You know, I've dropped down to my knee, and the only thing, like I said, the way I can describe it is, and this might sound really silly, man, my grandma always had really cold hands. And yeah, she yeah, if she saw you, yeah, standing somewhere, like she'd put her hands around on your belly, or yeah, just put cold hands on you, yeah, just because she knew that you always had cold hands. And this is what it was like. It was like someone had slipped their hand up my shirt and put their hand on my shoulder. But yeah, I thought it sounds silly, but that's the only way I could really describe it. It was like someone put their cold hand on my bare shoulder. But mind you, this is, yeah, winter time. It was about, yeah, 5 or 6 degrees at the time, and I was wearing a polar fleece jacket. So, but it felt like someone put their cold hand on my shoulder. And, mate, that made me freak, because when I looked around, there was no one there. And it was only at that point I looked at my left-hand side, and beside me was a grave. And the grave was of an Australian soldier, the 5th Australian Battalion. And he was flanked by other soldiers, also of the 5th Australian Battalion, who were killed on the 25th of July 1916. Now, this is the same battalion that James Council was a part of, and it's the same date that he actually lost his life. And so, mate, my wife got to me. She basically said, what the hell's happening? And she could see I was a mess. And my wife said to me, she goes, the atmosphere isn't right here. We have to get out. And she grabbed me by the arm. She helped me to my feet, which is, yeah, no mean feet. But I'm 6'7" and built like a brick shit house. But she helped me to my feet, and she walked me out. And the moment we stepped outside that cemetery, everything got calm. And so we just sat outside. I composed myself a little bit, and it was nice because there was actually a couple of English people, yeah, turned up to, yeah, look at the cemetery as well. And it was actually the first English I'd spoken in a couple of weeks. So I was able to, you know, sort of converse with these people and have a bit of a chat. And then I actually said to my wife, I said, look, I've got to go back in there and take a photo. And she goes, no, you're not going back in there. And then I'm going, no, look, I've got to do it. I've just got to do it. So I walked back in, and I found where it was because, you know, I still had knee marks on the ground. And I actually took a photograph of the unknown soldier and the other soldiers that, yeah, were side by side. Now, I didn't actually take any notice of any of the other names, but I was more interested in this unknown soldier. And like I said, mate, just talking about it rattles me. But that was one thing. The rest of the whole day was amazing. Yeah, we travelled around France. I went to England, Scotland, Ireland. Yeah, we went all over the place, and we went absolutely ball. Basically, got back home, and almost, yeah, within 12 months, yeah, we'd started a family, and yeah, things sort of, yeah, quietened down a little bit then. You know, even with my collecting, I didn't really sort of collect as much as what I used to, because we were trying to save money and, yeah, with the mortgage and stuff. So it wasn't up until it was probably a good 8-9 years, I suppose, later that when my kids really actually. Yeah, a little bit less than that, because when we started having kids, when my kids started going to school, my children would actually ask me if they could take items of my collection to school for show and tell. So you, you can imagine, like, the teachers scratching their head when the kids turn up with a German helmet or a gas mask. But as it got closer to Anzac Day, the school then approached my wife and said, look, where's all the stuff coming from? And she said that, about me having a big collection, and away we went. I then started putting on the exhibits again. And once again, I was able to pull out the diary and really, tell the kids about the First World War and its effect on families and so forth. But it was also, around about this time that the internet improved. I could actually gain access to service records, like really good service records, not just very basic ones. And that was where I was able to go and get the full service records of James Council. And I was really able to work around that and work out exactly where he was, where he was from, so forth. But this is where it got really interesting, because it was just one night when I was having a really good delve into his service records that I actually noticed that he actually had a known grave at some point. So he'd been buried in the field. And when he was buried in the field, whoever had buried him had actually made a point of recording his burial coordinates. So in his service records, it actually says he's buried in the field and with map reference, and has a map reference number. Now, this would narrow it down to just a square. I'm not even exactly sure just how big that square would have been. But, you could actually pinpoint on the map roughly where he was buried. But, of course, his grave was lost. Now, it was around about this time, too, that I actually was reading through a magazine. I actually have got the magazine in front of me. It was a wartime magazine, and this is actually dated 99. So now in this magazine, I was actually having a look through it, and there was here was a story about a soldier from the 5th Battalion, and a lot of the stuff that is actually mentioned in his diary coincides with my diary, with my soldier's diary. Now, the service records that I also had obtained told me one really, really important thing, and that's the fact that James Council was a Lewis machine gunner. He worked in a Lewis section, and with his Lewis machine gun sections, they were a light machine gun. They had like a big round cylindrical magazine that they mounted on top, and these were essentially like the very first mobile light machine gun, which was actually carried by crews of men during the First World War. They had the heavy machine guns, but these were the light ones, which would be carried. Now, these soldiers would actually work in sections. So you would have, there might be seven riflemen, and you would have the number one and the number two who would actually handle the Lewis machine gun. Now, every bloke in that section could handle that gun to some extent, but the number one and the number two were the blokes who would operate the gun. The other blokes would actually support it with rifle fire, and they would actually carry all the ammunition. Now, James Council was one of these men. He was in the Lewis gun section, which meant that I was actually able to narrow things down, because at this point in the war, there weren't that many Lewis gun sections allocated to a battalion of 1,000 men. In fact, I think there was four companies of, say, about 225 men, and each of those companies may have two Lewis gun sections. That was really interesting. But what was even more interesting is this story that I was actually reading about this soldier. His name was George Lundy. He was also a member of a Lewis gun section. And, it just when I'm reading through this story, he goes, once again, he's actually fighting in the Battle of Pozieres. Now, this man survived. But his description is quite amazing of what was actually happening throughout this battle. But there was one thing which really hit home, and I don't know why it hit home, but when I was reading about it, he actually mentions that on the 25th of July 1916, when they had gone into action, his own Lewis machine gun section had all been wiped out. They got hit by a big shell. Everyone was dead or dying, and he was working his way through these battered trenches, because he'd heard that there was another Lewis gun section that was off to his left-hand side, So he was, running through these trenches. And when he got there, his best mate was laying in this trench, and his best mate had his legs blown off, was bleeding to death. And this section, everyone in that section was wounded badly, either dead or badly wounded. And he was devastated because he was his mate with his legs blown off. The gun was also shattered, so it was no use to him. But his job was to try and get his gun back in action so they can go and repel this counterattack that we were snapping from the Germans. So he was devastated to think that he actually left his mate behind. Now, this bloke, he had a really unusual surname, and this is what really caught my attention. His name was Charles George Ruggles. And when I saw this name, I thought to myself, how do I know that name? And mate, this baffled me for a bit, and then all of a sudden, it hit me, and I went and grabbed my photograph album, from when I was in France. And here I was, I flicked through to the photograph that I went and took when I walked back into the cemetery. And the soldier who was laying next to the unknown soldier was Charles George Ruggles.
No.
So when you look at these things, my man was a Lewis machine gunner. George Ruggles was also a Lewis machine gunner. They worked in sections. Ruggles' crew was all wiped out and dead or dying. Now, the other really bizarre thing was when I was looking through George Ruggles' service records, I then produced his records and started flicking through them. Lo and behold, in his notes is the fact that he too was buried in the field, because of course he has a known grave. But there's a map reference with burial coordinates in a battlefield, and they are identical to Grange Council's burial coordinates. So these two men were actually buried in the same place.
That's incredible.
Just logistically,
for that to happen, that is incredible.
Yeah, and it's something I haven't really come across in many other service records that I've got. The fact that they had made a point of writing down his burial coordinates in his service records, and then of course his grave was lost. But here it is: two men from the 5th Battalion, both Lewis machine gunners, both with the same burial coordinates. And here it is. It's right next to Ruggles in the Posier Cemetery that I have this weird experience.
That has to be one of the most intricate synchronicities I have ever heard of.
Yeah. And look, this is, and once again, now I've got the goosebumps, mate. It's the sort of thing that just, when I talk about it, it rattles me. And I've spoken to a few people about this, what's it feel like? I'll say, it feels like I have someone sitting next to me. That's bizarre. I'm sitting on a lounge now, and I feel like someone's sitting with me. That's how I feel. And I'm starting to tear up a little bit now. But it's really bizarre, mate. So it doesn't really end there. So, like I said, I felt that was something that I couldn't prove. But because this soldier is already buried in an unknown grave and he's in a cemetery, there's no way of doing any DNA testing to retrieve his body and finding relatives and so forth. So I think, deep down in my own mind, even at this point, I felt that had to be him. Like, just the fact that I had the hand on my shoulder in the cemetery when I was following his footsteps, at that point, I felt that had to be him. But this just, me with my interested mind and I love researching things. When I start piecing all this together, it's, wow, this is incredible. So like I said, I've always put his diary on displays. I've always given talks about him. I've always made the point of the fact that he's never been forgotten. Not whilst, the diaries are in my possession. I've always told his story. I've always made the point of making sure that the kids understand, just how bloody horrible the First World War and any war is.
Yeah.
I've always used his diary as their is the real determining point that really might make them understand. So, mate, I'm going to jump forward a few years. So my son is a very, very talented bugler. And so he was actually given the opportunity to sound the last post at the Australian War Memorial. And this is like a huge honour. I mean, yeah, when I think of places to sound the last post, Gallipoli is number one. Villers Bretonneux in France is number two. You know, there's the Australian Memorial there. Maybe the Menin Gate, but, you know, one of the utmost, you know, incredible places to be able to go and do this is the Australian War Memorial. And so he was given the opportunity to go and do that. So, of course, all the family, yeah, we all, yeah, went to Canberra. Yeah, this is a big occasion. My son was, I believe he was the second oldest. The second youngest, I should say. The second youngest bugler to ever sound the last post at War Memorial. So this is brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. So, yeah, my son's actually, you know, taking his own bugle there. He stood up on the day, sounded the last post beautifully. But I was actually given the opportunity to go and lay a wreath. And I didn't actually tell any of the family, you know, what I'd done. They said I could dedicate the wreath to anyone. I actually dedicated the wreath to James Council. Thanked him for his service and for his sacrifice and said that he'd never be forgotten. I actually wrote this on the little card, put on the wreath, and that's what we laid at the War Memorial on this particular day. Huge honour. It was a huge honour for myself to be able to go and do something like that. But, mate, I was so proud to see my son up there, you know, sounding the last post. And in the pocket over his heart, he actually carried the photograph of James Council.
Oh, wow.
So that was a big thing.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Now, the following day, we actually went back to the memorial because at the end of this, the closing ceremony, they basically shut the place up really quick. And so we actually went back the following morning. I took the diary, the original diary with me. We found his name on the big memorial plaques on the wall. And my two sons were there. My mum was there. My wife is close by. And I said to my boys, yeah, can you maybe take my photograph with his name, yeah, on the wall? And I said, yeah, no worries, Dad. Yeah, so they got the cameras ready, and I crouched down, opened up the diary to his last entry. So they took the photo, and then the one thing that was really spooky was in the background, the War Memorial had playing. They had done recordings of school children from all local schools reading out the names of soldiers. So, for instance, you know, I might say, you know, Joe Blow, 2nd Battalion, with his age. And they would, you know, say, you know, someone else's name. And, yeah, you know, the battalion that they served with and their age. And this is just standing in the background. And it's saying like little kids, you know, they almost sound like, you know, first, second class kids just reading out these names. So this is playing in the background. So my sons have taken the photograph. I've stood back up. And then a name was read out. James Council, 5th Battalion, 21 years of age.
Another synchronicity.
And my mum looked at me and she said, did you just hear that? And she know, yeah, and she was aware of what happened in France and the other strange things that had happened. And mate, immediately, like I am now, goosebumps, and I started feeling sick. And it's like, what the hell? This is, yeah. And so we actually made the point of going to the memorial shop, and we said to them, the kids' voices and all these names. And they said, oh yeah, no, the memorial had a thing going where they approached all the local schools around the region. And of the 100,000 names, they were able to get about 10,000 names. And I'm just a wow. So out of 10,000 names, his name was read out the moment I stood at the wall at his name on the brass plaque for the 5th Australian, the Australian War Memorial. The moment I stood in front of it and opened that diary up, his name was read out.
You know, Kieran, I believe coincidences happen, but when a coincidence happens not once, not twice, but three times, that's no longer a coincidence in my eyes. That is that's the universe reaching out to you. And now, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Also, are you wanting more content? Why not become a Believe Plus member? You'll get access to exclusive podcasts and episodes that aren't available to the public. Not only that, you'll also get our regular feed without any ads. Head to believepod.com/plus to sign up today for just $5 a month.
That's exactly right. But wait, there's more. So this was 2020. This happened. It was just before COVID hit and really shut the place down. So yeah, we've got a few years, or a couple of years anyway. Now, last year, of all places, my wife and I and the group of friends went to the Northern Territory. We went to Darwin, traveled around Kakadu, so forth. On our last night, we actually went to a place called Bia. And this is a very spiritual place in Kakadu. It's a beautiful rock formation. There's indigenous rock art there. It's one of the most incredible places I've ever been to. And the only way I could really, I could really describe it would be like a massive pride rock, from Lion King. it's where this big rock had basically fallen down on top of another rock. And so you can actually walk on top of this thing. You can probably fit about 1,000 people on top of this rock. But they encourage people to go up there and watch the sunset. And that's exactly what we did there. We went there just before sunset, had a little bit of a walk around, and then walked up on top of this rock with everyone else that was there. And there was probably about 50, 60 people up on top of this rock. And it was just one of these really nice moments where everyone was taking photographs for each other, whether you knew them or not. And we're all just talking to each other. It was just a really... The vibe was just beautiful. And whilst we were up there, there was a group of school kids and their teachers that were close by. And one of them came and stood next to my wife. My wife said, "Would you like me to take a photograph for you?" And I think she did, yeah. And then my wife said to her, "Whereabouts are you guys from?" And she just looked and she goes, "Oh, we're from Tallangatha," which is the hometown of James Council. And mate, immediately I felt sick and I broke out into goosebumps. And it was at this point I said to my wife, because this teacher then excused herself and she raced off and did something with the kids. And I looked at my wife and she just said, "What's going on?" And I said, "Do you know where Tallangatha is?" And she just sort of shook her head and I said, that's where my soldier's from. I said, "Look at me. I feel sick. I've got covered in bloody goosebumps. I said, I've got to do something." And she's saying, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "I'm just going to go talk to someone." And that's exactly what I did. I actually went and I walked in the direction of a male school teacher that was with some of the students. And I just approached him. And I just introduced myself. I won't say his real name, but I'll say his name's John. She introduced myself. He introduced himself back, so forth. And we just got yakking, and I said to him, "Mate, I'm going to be up front with you. This is a really weird story. So you have to, bear with me." And I proceeded to tell him, about the diary I had, where it was from, the things that happened to me, overseas, without going into too much detail. But I said, "Mate, look, basically, ever since I've had this diary and ever since I've been to France, weird shit's happened." I said, not just all in one hit. This is over like a 20-year period, but strange things have happened, and now this has happened. I said, "Now, I'm going to show you my arms." I showed him my arms. I said, "Man, I'm covered in goosebumps. This is what happens to me." And he sort of stood there and he said, "Wow, that's incredible." He said, look, just out of curiosity, he said, what was that surname you just said? And I said, his name was James Council. And this teacher, he looked at me and he basically said, fuck off. I said, sorry? He goes, you're kidding me. I said, no, I'm not kidding. I said, his name's James Council. And he looked at me and he goes, it's spelled D-A-U-S-E-L-L. I said, yes, that's exactly right. And he said, look, without making too much of a thing, he said, turn around and look behind you. I turned around, looked behind me, and there was a couple of female students there. And he said, hey, the girls behind you are councils.
Oh, my God. I just got chills, Kieran.
So, and at that point, I said, look, I won't say anything to the students. Just in case, I said, it's going to be pretty weird having just a random bloke walk up and talk to them about this. He said to me, he said, look, my dad loved his family history. Would you like to pass on some details to me? And I'll have a chat with my dad. And we'll do what we can research and find out for you. I said, that would be fantastic. And I said, look, I said, are you a history teacher? And he said, yeah, I am. He said, oh, that's what he majored in, but he wasn't actually teaching history. But he said, but I am a history teacher, but I don't teach it at present. He said, but my best friend does. He's actually a history teacher at the same school. And I said, look, this is happening for a reason. I don't know why this is happening, but I feel like maybe his story should be told in his hometown. And he said, we would love to have that sort of information that can be passed on to our own students. He said, look, this is what we crave, like local stories like this. So I got his details, and I actually emailed everything off to him. And he said, look, he said, give me a buzz in a couple of weeks, and we'll have a bit of a catch up, and I'll have the chat with my dad, and so we can find out. I said, okay, look, that'll be great. So that was good. Yeah, 2 weeks later, I've got back. We had a fantastic time. That was funny. I was actually at work, and I received a text message from John, and basically said, can you give me a call this afternoon? Weird shit's already starting to happen. And that had me intrigued. So I messaged back to the city. Yeah, okay, no worries. What, about 4:30? He said, yep, that'll be great. So I got back home that afternoon, immediately jumped on the phone, and I gave John a call. And he pretty much said to me, he said, go get yourself a beer and go and sit down. He said, you're not going to believe this. I said, right, yeah, okay, hit me with it. He said, so first up, the two students that were behind you were definitely relations of the council family. I said, okay, that's quite incredible. He said, yeah, they was a large family. The soldier was one of nine children, and there's actually lots of there's quite a few descendants that still exist in Tauangala. I said, wow, okay, that's fantastic. That's really good to know. He said, that doesn't end there, Kieran. I said, okay. And then he proceeded to tell me that when he got home, he actually called up his dad, went out for dinner with him. Yeah, they went out a few beers, and he produced all the, because I sent photographs of the diary and all the pages and the transcripts and the stories. And because I've written stories about what happened to him in France. So I sent everything off to him, and he produced all this, and he read all this out to his father. And his father sort of sat back there just sipping on his beer. And in the end, his father said to him, he said, John, you don't know, do you? And he's John's like, looking at his dad, saying, what's wrong, Dad? What do you mean? And he says, you honestly don't know, do you? And he's like, no, Dad, what don't I know? He said, John, years ago, our family, John actually told me that his family went back generations in Tauangala. So he was like a born and bred Tauangala boy. Now, John's father proceeded to then tell him that when it wasn't all that long ago, within the last 30, 40 years, their family had actually purchased a farm that was their neighbour's, the neighbouring farm. And John's saying, yeah, what about that? And he said that was the council farm. He said, John, we actually purchased the council farm. The land that we live on now is the council land.
This is getting nuts, Kieran.
And just to really top it off, he said, now, you know how you used to jump on your motorbike and ride around the fences? And John said, yeah, I do. He said that the occupation of James Council was a boundary rider. He said, so essentially, you know, when you used to go and jump on your motorbike and ride around the fences and, yeah, check all the fences, he said, you're a boundary rider. So you've been approached by a person that you don't know, thousands and thousands and thousands of kilometres away on a rock in the Northern Territory. Well, you know, this person you don't know from Burra Soap has approached you, asked you about a soldier from the First World War. It just so happens that his occupation was the same as your occupation on the same farm.
I'm honestly speechless. This is so far out of being normal that it is almost impossible to comprehend that this is real.
No, no.
It is so, there's so many strings connecting so many people back to this one individual that it's such a mind-twisting story, and I am shocked by it. Out of everyone that you could have picked in your historical adventures, you chose this gentleman, and it took you down this path. It is...
When I spoke to him on the phone, and I said, I'm breaking down goosebumps again, mate, I'm sorry. And that's what he said. He said, it took me, he said, I now understand what you're going through and what you've, he said, because this is bizarre. He said, why is it you walked up to me? I said, I don't know. I said, but when I came up and spoke to you, John, I felt sick and I broke out and, I was covered in goosebumps. I said, so here it was. And he said, Kieran, there were students behind you that are relations. And then you've approached me and my family own the bloody farm. I said, I know. That's
it is so truly nuts. And I always, I think I even said it at the start of this episode, I always try to do episodes that are unique and different and kind of strange so people can kind of understand that they're not alone with their experiences. But I have to tell you, Karen, you've absolutely wiped the table of everything, because nothing has ever come close to having so many synchronicities attached to it in this podcast ever.
Yeah, and look, it's I think that is the interesting thing about this. It's something that physically I can never prove that this is him. But through everything that's happened, I can't believe that it can't not be him.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It is almost fate.
And yeah, I mean, look, yeah, without, yeah, like sounding, yeah, like too weird with all this, I was actually with, met my wife and myself and my daughter. We went and visited an uncle and aunt down the south coast, and they had a friend pop over who was actually sensitive, you know, to all this sort of stuff. And I had actually told my auntie and uncle about this, and it's funny, whenever I tell the story, I often expect someone to have a reaction of, oh, that's all bullshit, rah rah rah. But you know, I've never ever had anyone ever say that to me. It's always been quite the opposite. It's like, wow, it has to be him. And that's always been the reaction. Now, this lady had a very interesting sort of reaction when I was talking about her, about what had happened. And the one thing that she actually said to me, she said, I feel like he's maybe attached himself to you. She said, yeah, that might explain why you break out the goosebumps, why you feel sick. She said, look, they're physical things, and yeah, maybe there's some sort of attachment. Maybe you know, yucky, you may have attached myself to you in France. I don't know.
It's one of those things that, and you really do, you have to be a really big believer of what, you know, that person is telling you, because I am always on the fence when it comes to people who say that, you know, they're sensitive and then they give out information based off that, because I always think that's a really dangerous route to kind of go down, because not to say people are lying, but maybe they are just misunderstanding what they're feeling. Yeah. And, you know, that's totally normal. Like, you look at anyone and they can totally misread a situation. It's just kind of part of being human.
Mm.
But I tell you what, it definitely does sound like something is with you, because who knows? Like, I wonder, and this is complete speculation, Kieran, but I wonder if you've had so many sliding door scenarios where you've decided to do something over something else that's led you to another kind of thread of synchronicities for this individual.
Yeah, yeah. And did you know what? I mean, there's a few other little things which have happened, which is just little, like, bizarre things. And I look back now, I mean, it was only last year that my daughter, for a school assignment, and it was for an exhibit at the school for history, she actually made a replica of this diary. I mean, she did a beautiful job of it. It's like a larger version of it. She actually stained all the paperwork with tea and coffee and stuff, and then wrote it in pencil and wrote it the same as what he had written it, and actually used that as an exhibit with the story of him, with photographs and that sort of stuff. And even at this exhibit, which we're sort of in a fairly rural area of close to Newcastle. Whilst we were there, and all these people were just, just a handful of, I wouldn't say there was hundreds of people. There was, a few people coming through looking at the exhibit after hours at the school. A lady actually had a look at it and said, "Oh, I'm actually from Tallangala."
Yeah.
And then proceeded to tell me what the place was like and rah, rah, rah. And she said, "Oh, I don't recognize the name, but that's really, just little things like that. I mean, but someone from, from Tallangala is actually at the school. I don't know. Like, maybe I'm looking too much into it. It's just, but look, what was also very nice when John finished telling me about what his father, told me about the farm and so forth. And this really calmed me down for some reason. It was a really nice feeling when he actually said that the diary, the copies of the diary and the transcript and the stories are actually now being used at Tallangala Secondary College for teaching students.
Oh, wow. That is excellent. It's kind of
so,
like, he's ingrained his own history within his own town.
Yes. So that was one thing. I was so emotional over that. It's like, are you kidding me? He goes, no, it's going to be used at school.
An immense sense of pride about that, I would imagine, because, you've taken this soldier who has essentially been forgotten to history, and you've brought his story home, and it's never going to be forgotten now.
Yeah, I know. It is pretty special. I mean, look, I've always done my very best to make sure his story is told, but I live in New South Wales. Newcastle, New South Wales, not Victoria, but to think that now his story is actually being told at his own town at a high school, I think that is pretty special. But it's still pretty freaky just how all this sort of stuff has fallen into place like it has. I've got no way of really explaining how I feel with all that. It is pretty bizarre.
Yeah, absolutely. And, it's one of those things that you may never know the answer to until, who knows, one day if you cross over and you ever find out that way. Because I tell you what, it definitely seems like there's some otherworldly things at play when it comes to this. I know that sounds very almost airy-fairy and a little very, very speculative, but I tell you what, Kieran, I've never heard of a story with so many directional changes to make something happen in my life.
Yeah.
Like, it is truly, truly fascinating, and I just have such difficulty comprehending it, because I can only imagine how this was for you.
Oh, mate, look, yeah, just the experience in France was enough for me. just having the hand on my shoulder in the cemetery and having no one there, and, mate, that was enough to spook me. And, you know, look, nothing like that happened in any other cemetery. I never had any feelings like that. But that one cemetery in Poitiers, mate, it just rattled me. That really, really rattled me. But just to think that, you know, everything else seems to fight on. It's almost like floodgates have opened up since then, just with what little experiences. And I mean, you know, of course, you know, I was talking about some other things that have happened to me, but I can't say I ever really had anything happen until like this. And I've heard stories of, you know, when you have your first experience that it can actually open the floodgates. It's almost like a beacon comes on and you're left wide open to things. And mate, sometimes I just feel that's exactly what happens.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Believe Paranormal and UFO podcast. If you have had an encounter and you would like to share it, please get in touch with me. My email address is believepod@gmail.com. Finally, don't forget to follow us on all our social media outlets and be sure to join our Discord server to talk to other listeners of the show. You'll find all these links in our show notes. Thank you.